Not yet.
Not yet? Okay. Hello? Okay. Welcome to this presentation on Islam. Okay, so you find yourself in Afghanistan. You're in a room with about 20 Muslims. They're drinking tea and talking to each other. All of a sudden, the conversation stops, and one of them turns to you and says, "What do you have to say about the three gods of Christianity?" Everyone in the room turns and looks at you. Not a comfortable situation. What do you say? You know that Muslims are strict monotheists. You know that they completely reject and absolutely hate the idea of a tripersonal God. So what do you say? Fortunately for you, you're a member of the new church. You have access to these amazing books called the Heavenly Doctrines, and you've done some research on what they have to say about Islam. You remember a quote from the spiritual diary that talks about the Greeks who live with the Muslim Ottoman Turks. I probably should use my glasses here. There were with me many from Greece who dwell with the Mohammedans. They complained about the Mohammedans, that they often tell them that they worship three gods. But the Greeks replied that they worship one God and that the three gods are one. But yet the Mohammedans persist that there are three whom they worship, since they name three and think of three. But the Greeks still reply that they worship one God. When the Mohammedans ask which God of the three, they reply that they worship all together. The Mohammedans do not desist from this infestation until the Greeks reply that they are merely names of the one God. Then the Mohammedans become silent. So you respond. The three names of God in the Christian book are like the many names of God in the Quran. The Muslims are silent for a short time, absorbing what you said, and then continue on with their conversation. And you think to yourself, the heavenly doctrines gave me exactly what I needed to say. And as time goes on, you see other examples of the heavenly doctrines giving you just the right concept or just the right application for dealing with Muslims. Fast forward to the present. There are now some people associated with the new church who have been raising questions about the writings' accuracy on the subject of Islam. They claim that the writings are mistaken on some very basic points, and also say that perhaps Swedenborg the man really couldn't have known that much about Islam. And there seem to be others who perhaps wonder, even if the heavenly doctrines are accurate and divinely inspired, whether what they have to say is really all that relevant to the situation that we find ourselves in today. So the purpose of this presentation is first and foremost to help you determine whether or not the heavenly doctrines are accurate on Islam. And secondarily, to get you to perhaps consider the possibility that they should be your go-to source for this situation facing us today. The writings tell us that question and answer is the best way to learn. Unfortunately, we have a lot of ground to cover. I'm hoping that comments and questions can, for the most part, wait to the end of the talk so we don't get bogged down. The presentation will be very simple and straightforward, basically a comparison of quotes from the writings with quotes from the Quran. It's not going to be all that exciting. Hopefully, it will be useful. If you can put up with this for an hour or so, those who are interested should be able to get into a more interesting give and take discussion at the end of the talk. As we're addressing the various questions, you might want to keep your eye out for religious, ideological concepts and spiritual concepts that could perhaps be used in the conflict we find ourselves in today. So let's get started. Are the Heavenly Doctrines statements about Islam divinely inspired? There are basically six questions that were raised in New Church Life. I've based my questions on them. Some of them are more relevant than others, but anyhow. Is the Allah of the Quran based on divine revelation as the writings indicate, or is he an illegitimate, idolatrous entity? Do Mohammedans really believe that Jesus is the Son of God as the heavenly doctrines state? Do Mohammedans believe that Jesus was the greatest prophet, as the heavenly doctrines say they do? What could Swedenborg the man have possibly known about Islam? Could Swedenborg have had access to the Quran? And do the commandments of the Decalogue exist in the Quran as the heavenly doctrines say they do? So let's start with the first one. Who is Allah? Notice the H pronounced strongly on the end. I read once in a new church educational document that the H in Yehovah is silent, and I don't believe that's correct. I'm almost positive that Yehovah is the way that it should be pronounced. If you're interested in learning Hebrew, I would suggest studying Arabic. Arabic. They have the glottal stop, they have the rolling R's, they have the H, they have the K, they have the V, they have it all. So anyhow, if you want to learn Hebrew, that would be my recommendation. According to a 2009 poll, 10% of Americans believe that Muslims are pagans who worship a moon god or goddess. The author of the New Church Life article basically said that the God of the Quran was a sun god. The name Allah. Ilah is Arabic for small god, like a polytheistic type god. Allah is Arabic for the big god, the supreme god. The word Allah is probably from the conjunction of Al-Ilah, the God, and there is no other word for God in the Arabic language. So, if the Kempton Project ever decides to do an Arabic translation of the writings, we are going to be using the word Allah. So get used to it. The Arabic word Allah is closely related to the scriptural Hebrew words El, Elohim, and Eloah, and to the scriptural Aramaic Elah used in the book Elah, used in the book of Daniel. Scriptural Arabic, Hebrew, and Aramaic are Semitic languages. Do we want the lights off or not?
No.
Okay. Scriptural Arabic, Hebrew, and Aramaic are Semitic languages. Other ancient Semitic languages such as Syriac, Akkadian, Ugaritic, and Phoenician also use words similar to El, Elohim, Allah, for God. The original root meaning for the scriptural Hebrew word for God is power, might, strength. I haven't really found that Allah is, I haven't found what the root meaning for Allah is. I'm assuming it's the same as El and Elohim. So anyway, here's AC 4402. The singular name El or God is used where the power which comes from divine truth is the subject. The Semitic words for God, including the word Allah, are thousands of years old. They predate Islam and Middle Eastern polytheism. Some people get spooked out by the word Allah. They think it's some spooky Muslim word. Other people say, well, this so-called Muslim word is really just a polytheistic borrowed word. Neither one of those is correct. The writings say that this Noachian or ancient church was diffused throughout Asia and also into Arabia. The writings say some interesting things about Arabia, one of which is, it sounds like one of the quotes from the writings say that the wise men came from Arabia, which makes sense because that's where frankincense and myrrh are produced. Arab Christians were using the word Allah for God centuries before the rise of Islam and continue to use it to this day. There is, in fact, no other word for God in Arabic. If you go into Samoyer's Bakery in Allentown, you will meet a Christian gentleman named Abdullah, which is, means servant of Allah. Like I say, he is Christian. I don't know how common that is, but okay, let me quickly go back. Do I personally use the word Allah? If a Catholic comes up to me and says, do you believe in God? I say yes. Now, if he wants to take it further, do you believe in this, this, and this? Then I'll say, okay, we have a difference. But if a Muslim comes up to me and says, do you believe in Allah? Absolutely. Absolutely, I'd say yes. And I would mean it. I think you have to be careful not to portray yourself as being something that you're not. But on the other hand, I'm not going to get into an argument with someone who believes in God. I'm just not going to do it. Anyhow, the Muhammadan religion was raised up by the divine providence of the Lord to destroy the idolatries of many nations. Does the Quran indicate that Allah is a sun or a moon god? Here are some quotes from the Quran. And of his signs are the night and the day and the sun and the moon. Do not prostrate to the sun or the moon, but prostrate prostrate to Allah, who created them, if it should be him that you worship. This is a quote about Abraham, Ibrahim, and mentioned when Abraham said to his father, Azar, do you take idols as gods? Indeed, I see that you and your people are in manifest error. And thus did we, God, show Abraham the realm of the heavens and the earth, that he would be among the certain. When night overspread him, he saw a star and said, this is my Lord. But when it set, he said, I love not the setters. Kind of strange. Yeah. He saw the moon rising. He said, this is my Lord. But when it set, he said, if my Lord does not guide me, I should be surely of the people gone astray. When he saw the sun rising, he said, this is my Lord. This is greater. But when it set, he said, oh, my people, surely I quit that with which you associate. I have turned my face to him who made the heavens and the earth. I'm a man of pure faith and not one of the idolaters. Abraham's kind of an interesting character in the Quran. He's almost like a comic, idol-smashing superhero. He slaps idols, he smashes them, and then when people ask what happened to him, he said, well, this idol smashed all these idols. Anyhow, he's kind of a fun guy. The other big anti-idolatry guy other than Muhammad is Moses, who confronts Pharaoh as a god king. Okay, another quote. If you ask them, the Arabian idolaters, who created the heavens and the earth and subjected the sun and the moon, they would surely say, Allah. How then are they deluded? This gives us an idea of the kind of worship that was going on. It's they believed in the supreme being, but they had these side things going on. Planets, stones, sacred places, holy ancestors, that whole thing. And that's the kind of thing that can be applied to us as well. It's not, we can worship Jesus Christ, but we have some side things going on too. And the Quran has a real problem with that, as does our church, I assume. All right. Scholarly sources tell us that Allah was considered by pre-Islamic Arabs to be the supreme deity creator, God in their pantheon of gods. Warn hereby those who fear that they will be brought before their Lord. There is no protecting ally nor intercessor beside him that they may ward off evil. Intercession is a big issue in the Quran. Completely rejected. You go to Allah, that's your go-to guy. There's no one else, and no one's going to save you from the day of judgment. Question, do we in the new church have an intercessor? We do. We absolutely do. Jesus Christ is the intercessor. He is the way. He is the door. So if you want to go to the go-to guy, he's the go-to guy. All right, shirk. Shirk means sharing or association. This is the big sin in Islam. One Islamic commentator called it a horrific crime. A crime is what he called it. So Allah does not forgive partners being set up with him, but he forgives anything else to whomever he pleases. To set up partners with Allah is to devise a sin most heinous indeed. Truly he who associates others with Allah, Allah has forbidden paradise, and his abode will be the fire. Surely you disbelievers and what you worship are the firewood of hell. That's a fairly vivid picture. Just out of curiosity, does the new church teach that there is a real live hell of fire?
Yes,
it does. The Gehenna of fire sounds like a place where the sirens end up, and when you're not, it sounds like they're okay as long as they don't transgress the limits, but when they do, they get burned. And when they're not getting burned, apparently they get bitten by venomous snakes. So, not a good place. No. Something to aspire to if you really want to. Anyhow, the Orientals acknowledge God, the creator of the universe. They were unable to acknowledge anyone else. He is Allah, the creator, the maker, the fashioner. Is there a creator other than Allah to give you sustenance from heaven or earth? There is no God but He. Such is Allah, your Lord. There is no God but Him, the creator of all things. A Mohammedan sees from the Quran that God is one. The idea that God is one, it seems to be a very simple idea, but it seems like if you kind of look at it, it's actually really, really powerful. Before TCR discusses much else, the first thing it really discusses in depth is the oneness of God. Before Jesus Christ, before the Holy Spirit, before charity and good works and shunning evils, God is one is the big thing. So I think the Mohammedans have something here that's worth us keeping in mind as well. The Tawheed, that is the assertion of oneness, Islam's most fundamental concept. That's basically what Islam's all about. One, one, one. La ilaha illallah. There is no God but God. This is called this is the first part of the Shahada, the testimony of faith. Anyone out there? Anyhow, so ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. I testify that there is no God, no little God, but the big God. Anyone else? The root word, I believe, is shaheed, which means witness or testimony. It also means martyr. Does anyone know of another language where martyr and witness are the same word?
Greek.
Correct. New Testament Greek. Jesus Christ is the faithful martyr slash witness. Jesus Christ, the heavenly doctrines support that statement. So when you see witness in the New Testament, there's a good chance that the word martyr is underneath the surface there, which is kind of scary in some circumstances. Anyhow, back to God be one. He, Allah, is one, and your God is one. There is no God but Him, the most merciful, the especially merciful. This phrase, the most merciful, the especially merciful, occurs over and over and over again in the Quran. You see it everywhere. I read once that mercy is the most common word in the Quran, but I haven't been able to find that again, so I don't know if it's true. It's certainly possible. Okay, back to the oneness of God. The other nations in the world possessing a religion and sound reason agree in acknowledging that God is one, as do all the Mohammedans in their empires. Okay, what is the nature of this one creator God? The names and attributes of Allah. This is one quote from the Quran that just gives us a bunch of His names. There are apparently supposed to be 99 names of Allah being the 100th, but apparently that's not exactly correct. I don't know if it's more or less in the Quran, but anyhow, He is Allah, besides whom there is no God, the knower of the seen and the unseen. He is the most merciful, the especially merciful, that phrase again. He is Allah, besides whom there is no God, the King, the Holy One, the Peace, the Granter of Security, the Guardian over all, the Mighty One, the Supreme, the Possessor of every greatness. Glory be to Allah. High is He above any partner that they associate with Him. He is Allah, the Creator, the Maker, the Fashioner. To Him belong the most excellent of names. All that are in the heavens and the earth glorify Him, and He is the Almighty and the All-Wise. So call upon Allah or call upon Ar-Rahim, the most merciful. Again, whichever name you call upon Him by, to Him belong the most beautiful names. The word Ar-Rahim, Ar-Rahman, is in a number of places basically just substituted for Allah. So if you said to a Muslim Ar-Rahman, that's Allah. Just an interesting fact there. Two of the names of Allah. There are many names of Allah, but we're just going to focus on these two. Ar-Rahman, the most merciful, supposed to be the elevative form. and Ar-Rahim, the especially merciful, the intensive form. Does anyone buy that? Anyhow, both names are based on the Arabic word Rahmah. The word means mercy and has elements of the word for compassion, kindness, gentleness, tenderness, sympathy, love, protection, nourishment, kinship, and family. The primary meaning of the Arabic noun root word Raham is womb. This is a really, really beautiful name. There are related names for Allah, the acceptor of repentance, the compassionate, the loving, the forbearing one, the source of goodness, and the most generous. Just so you know, there are other names for God in the Quran. The avenger, the afflictor, the compeller, the abaser, the giver of dishonor. And when we're thinking about the God being most merciful, you have to keep in the back of your mind, if, of course, you don't worship someone else, in which case he will burn you in hell for all eternity. So, anyhow. And there are apparently seven different hells of fire. I don't know if you can choose, but one way or another, you're going to burn. So, all right, the Bismillah is the phrase Bismillah, Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the most merciful, the especially merciful, begins every chapter of the Quran but one. It occurs 114 times in the Quran. So this is just pounded home, pounded home, pounded home. I was on a Facebook discussion not too long ago, and they were talking about ISIS, and there were some people on there saying, well, you know, perhaps there's reasons for the way they're behaving, and I just commented, you know, if you believe that the Quran says that God is the most merciful, how can you possibly buy into that? There's no excuse, and that basically just shut the conversation down. So, anyhow, limitless is your Lord in his mercy. Here's a quote from Divine Love and Wisdom. I was at home one night, getting tired. I'm reading Divine Love and Wisdom. I thought, I'll read one more quote. And this one showed up. And it was about Islam, right in the middle of Divine Love and Wisdom. One cannot deny that in God there is love and wisdom, mercy and clemency, and also goodness itself and truth itself, inasmuch as these are from God. And because he cannot deny this, neither can he deny that God is a man. For abstractly for man, not one of these is possible. For man is their subject, and to separate them from their subject is to say that they are not. Think of wisdom and place it outside of man. Is it anything? In a word, the form of wisdom is man. And because man is the form of wisdom, he is also the form of love, mercy, clemency, good, and truth. Because these make one with wisdom. Love and wisdom are not possible except in a form. So what the writings are basically saying here, if you believe in these attributes, you have to believe that there's something human involved. They say more than that, but so is the God of the Quran human? I think a Muslim would say, throw up the wall and say, absolutely not. If you started, you know, what about this, what about that, then they'd say, okay. I talked to an imam from Princeton, and he said, yes, we acknowledge these things, but we don't think about it too much. We try not to overthink it. So they're aware of it. They're not quite sure how to deal with it. But anyhow, it's on the radar. So the face, eyes, hands, and shin of God in the Quran. These are actual examples of, what is it, anthropomorphic qualities? Is that the correct word? Anyhow, everything will be destroyed except his face. And there will remain the face of your Lord, owner of majesty and honor. So wait patiently for the decree of your Lord, for truly you are under our eyes. And we carried him upon an ark made of planks floating under our eyes. And I cast on you belovedness for me, that you might be brought up under my eye. Anyhow, it goes on and on. The right hand I have made with my hands, The Jews say the hand of Allah is chained. Chained are their hands, and cursed are they for what they say. Nay, both of his hands are widely outstretched. The hand of Allah is above their hands. On the day the shin shall be uncovered, I believe that's the day of resurrection, they shall be summoned to bow in adoration. Apparently Muslims do believe that you cannot see God in this world. They use Moses as an example. In the Quran, Moses, he asks God if he can see him, and I forget exactly what happens, but basically a minor disaster. After death, Muslims do believe that at least at this, maybe the day of judgment, that they will be able to see God. All right, a quote from Spiritual Diary. Respecting those who are in the mountains there, they indeed think of Muhammad when first they come into the other life, but afterwards they abandon him and think of God the Father, the creator of the universe, and of the Lord as the grand prophet, wisest of men and son of God. They were examined as to what sort of idea they had of the one God, the creator of the universe, and it was ascertained that it was, as it were, of something human. These are good Mohammedans. Is the God of the Quran based on divine revelation? Under the Lord's divine providence, a new religion arose, adapted to the genius of the Orientals, in which there was something from the word of both testaments. Divine providence. The religious principle with Mohammedans was in some respect taken from the word of both testaments. What does the Quran say? And he, God, will teach him, Jesus, the book, the Quran, the wisdom, not quite sure what that is, and the Torah and the gospel. So they acknowledge the Torah and the gospel. He has sent down the book to you with truth, confirming what came before it. And he sent down the Torah and the gospel. The God of the Quran is the God of Aaron, Abraham, Adam, Caleb, David, Eber, Elijah, Elisha, Enoch, Ezekiel, Isaac, Ishmael, Jethro, Jesus, Job, John the Baptist, Jonah, Joseph, Joshua, Lot, Mary, Moses, Noah, Samuel, Saul, Solomon, the sons of Jacob, Terah, and Zechariah. Something we should be fairly familiar with. The God of the Quran is not a moon god or a sun god. He is not an idol. He is not of polytheistic origin. He may not be something we're completely comfortable with. But according to both the Quran and the heavenly doctrines, the God of the Quran is one, is the creator, has divine human names and attributes, and is based on or influenced by the Old and New Testaments. So I think the author in New Church Life had it wrong. I don't think Muhammad really, or Allah really is a sun god. Okay, Jesus, the Son of God. Let's go for it. The Muhammadans acknowledge the Lord as the greatest prophet and as the Son of God. The Muhammadan religion acknowledges the Lord as the Son of God. And the Christians say the Messiah is the Son of God. That is the saying in their mouths. They but imitate what the unbelievers of old used to say. The curse of Allah be upon them. How they are turned away from the truth. Oops. And they say the Most Merciful has taken a son. Truly you have put forth an abominable thing. It is not worthy of the Most Merciful that he should take to himself a son. It would appear that we have a problem here. The only possible conclusions, Swedenborg did not know what he was talking about, and perhaps the heavenly doctrines are not quite as divinely inspired as they say they are. So what we are going to do is take a little detour here. We're going to pause on this particular one and take a detour. Oh, man. Oh, no. Okay. We're going to take a detour and look at what Swedenborg the man could have known about Islam, since that has become a question. It shouldn't be an issue. Swedenborg is a revelator. He is... He's not a historian, he's not a theologian, he's a revelator. Swedenborg didn't need to know about the most ancient people. He didn't need to meet someone from the Silver Age. But in any event, it's an issue with some people, and it's an interesting story, so we're going to just go with it. What could Swedenborg have possibly known about Islam? At first glance, the answer would appear to be not much. He was an 18th century Scandinavian living in a nation whose state religion since the mid-16th century had been the Lutheranism of the Church of Sweden. There are a lot of interesting quotes in the Heavenly Doctrines about Islam. There's some really quirky ones, and this is one of the quirky ones. He, speaking of Charles XII of Sweden, praised the Mohammedan religion above the Christian. When I first saw this, I'm like, what are you talking about? What could Charles XII possibly have known about Mohammedanism? It's ridiculous. So what I decided to do was to do a 5-minute internet search. What a concept. So again, what could an 18th century Scandinavian Christian possibly have known about Islam? Well, let's find out. Here is Sweden, modern day Sweden. Here is the Swedish Empire at the time of Swedenborg and Charles XII. You can see part of Norway has been taken, a big chunk of Finland, and a chunk of Russia, Latvia, I think, Saxony, Germany, and I thought maybe that's a part of Denmark, I'm not sure. Anyhow, that's what Charles XII started off with. This is Charles XII at age 15. In my opinion, not a particularly impressive looking character. But what you don't realize is that this wimpy looking guy is actually this guy. He is one of the most hardcore soldiers to walk the face of the modern earth. He is basically a warrior king. He was known as the Lion of the North and the Last of the Vikings. Later on in his life, he became, instead of the Lion of the North, he became known as the Madman of the North. But that's later on. So anyhow, this wimpy guy here was, he ascended the throne at age 15. Just to let everyone know who was in charge, he placed the crown on his own head. Just in case people wanted to know where he was coming from. The story is that he was born on a night when there was a terrible thunderstorm and that he came out of his mother with blood on his hands. I don't know if that's a common occurrence or not, but that's the legend. The folks who messed with Charles XII should have possibly considered that his father-son, his favorite father-son activity with his dad was hunting wild bears with sharpened stakes. And apparently one of them got so close to Charles XII that it knocked his hat off. So he said it was fairly easy to do, though. Anyhow, this is the warrior king, Charles XII. He was energetic, aggressive, extraordinarily courageous. He had trained himself from a young age to become impervious to pain. He was innovative, brilliant, and able in the heat of battle to sum up the situation and make a clear decision. He personally commanded and led from the front and expected his officers to do the same. An admirable quality. He had a highly trained modern army, was creative in the use of logistics, used rapid massive cavalry movement, was skilled at outmaneuvering his opponents, made effective use of artillery, used bold surprise attacks against larger forces, specializing in the use of bayonet charges. He was loved by his men and appeared to be affable and virtuous. The writings say that he had this peculiar ability of interior thought. And he was able to just size things up in a moment. So he was one radical, hardcore soldier. The downside, the writings tell us he was extremely stubborn. He didn't believe in compromise. He was contemptuous of his enemies. And according to the writings, was far more concerned about his own personal glory than the good of the Swedish people. A note of interest, one comment was that he was uncomfortable around women. If you know what happened to him in the next life, you might understand why. He ended up with someone from the planet Venus, I believe, who was like a really wicked, wicked individual. Anyhow, so that was Charles XII. And there is Charles XII. This is the first half of the Great Northern War. What happened was Russia, Poland, Saxony, Denmark, Norway, all decided to gang up on this wimpy 15-year-old. Big mistake, at least in the short term. So this is the first half of the Great War, Northern War, very self-explanatory. Looks like a big ball of spaghetti. Charles XII pretty much took on the Poles, the Germans, the Norwegians, and the Danes first, but in one of his most famous battles, the Battle of Narva, he took on Peter the Great of Russia, the Tsar. And he went into the Russians were in a defensive position. They outnumbered his army by either 3 to 5 to 1. There was a snowstorm going on. Charles XII's generals were telling him, "Don't attack! Don't attack! We have to do something different." All of a sudden, the wind changed and started blowing directly into the faces of the Russians. Charles XII summed up the situation immediately, ordered an attack, split the Russian army into three parts. A bunch of people fled and drowned. And the Swedes ended up capturing more Russians than were in the Swedish army. It's considered to be perhaps the greatest victory in Swedish history. Charles XII was 18 years old when he accomplished that feat. So he was a rather amazing individual. He makes for a good cautionary tale, we should say that. Anyhow, this is Charles XII accepting the defeat of the Russian forces at Narva. And there's Charles XII. So anyhow, after dealing with the Poles and the Saxons and the Norwegians and the Danes, Charles XII decides that he's going to invade Russia. I think he was the first guy who made that leap. Anyhow, you almost have to feel sorry for the guy. If anyone could have done it, you'll feel like he was the guy. He had to leave a bunch of men behind to prop up the Polish king that he had installed. A relief column that was coming with 10,000 men and a bunch of supplies was ambushed by the Russians. He tried to link up with the Cossacks, 100,000 men and all the supplies he could have ever wanted, but the Russians attacked the Cossack capital, and so he ended up with a small percentage of the Cossacks. Peter the Great had initially said, let's sue for peace, let's talk this over. Charles XII's response was, "We'll talk about peace when I take Moscow." So anyhow, he was a rather, that was Charles XII. But he had the misfortune of invading Russia during the winter that was the coldest winter in 500 years. I believe it was called the Great Chill or something like that. His men were freezing to death, starving, there was food poisoning, on and on and on. Charles XII kind of limped down into the Ukraine and he was wounded. A week before the Battle of Poltava, he was wounded. He had blood poisoning. He was out of the action. One of his men had to take over and did not perform very well. There's the Cossack behind the wounded Charles XII. And what happened was Peter the Great of Russia won the battle. So, what the heck does this have to do with Islam? Charles XII and 543 of his men managed somehow to escape the clutches of the Russians, which was fortunate for them. The rest of the army was sent into slavery in Russia, never to be seen again. So they limped their way, escaped their way down to the castle at Tegina, I guess is how you pronounce it. Again, what does this have to do with Islam? Here is where Charles XII ended up, I think right up in there somewhere. I once asked a new churchman, what do you think about having the heavenly doctrines as your primary go-to source on Islam? And he said, well, the writings don't tell us anything about the caliphate. Would anyone like to tell me what this red octopus is? That is the caliphate. Charles XII and 543 men were under the protection of the Islamic Ottoman Caliphate for 5 years, believe it or not. Russia and Sweden were allies against their mutual enemy, Tsarist Russia. So this is the court of Ahmed III, the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. There he sits on his throne. And he sits again on his throne. There's a nice picture of him. Anyhow, the relationship between Sweden and the Ottoman Empire. Diplomatic contacts between Sweden and the Ottoman Empire had been initiated in the mid-16th century. Letters were exchanged as far back as 1587, 100 years before Swedenborg was born. Remember, we're talking about what could Swedenborg have known about Islam. The first official Swedish envoy was sent to Ottoman Turkey in 1631, more than half a century before Swedenborg was born. Given the fact that Sweden and the Ottoman Empire were allies, it seems likely that Swedenborg could have had access to secondhand information on Islam through Swedish military officers, envoys, government officials, businessmen, religious scholars, etc. Could he have had any firsthand personal interaction with Muslims back in Sweden? Again, Sweden was under the control of the Swedish Lutheran Church. Charles XII and 543 Swedes spent 5 years in Bender under the protection of the Ottoman Empire. Charles incurred tremendous debts to the Ottoman government and also to the local merchants who supplied the army with equipment and provisions. When Charles XII finally returned to Sweden, a large number of private Muslim creditors followed him there. In 1718, Charles XII issued a royal decree legalizing the practice of worship by Muslim debt collectors residing in Sweden. So, could Swedenborg have had firsthand access to Muslims? Beginning in 1727, the Ottoman Empire, in an attempt to collect the debt owed to it, sent the following two ambassadors to Sweden. This is Kazbeksi Mustafa Aga, 1727 to 1728. This is Mehmed Said Efendi, 1733 to 1734. These guys were enormous celebrities. Mehmed Said Efendi said the following about the reception he received at Stockholm in 1733. They filled up all the spaces in the houses, shops, and rooftops, and in addition, all the ships, even the ropes tying the ships to the port, where on every rope they looked like a bunch of grapes. The people, upon seeing us, waved their hats in the air and all together cried out in their language, "Long live the Padishah of the Ottomans." So this was a huge deal. These guys were like exotic, interesting. Everybody knew about them, and they had interaction with the Swedish king. They went to the royal court. Anyhow, the first Ottoman envoy, Kazbeksi Mustafa Aga, accompanied by a retinue of 23, arrived in Stockholm in 1727 and stayed there for 15 months. Attendance records show that Swedenborg was in Stockholm working at the College of Mines during this entire period. Could Swedenborg have had access to Aga or his retinue? I would certainly think so. He's a well-connected nobleman. What's that?
You might say there's a probability.
I would certainly think so. There is an interesting quote. Well, Swedenborg is accused by a Swedish clergyman of his doctrine smacking of Mohammedanism. And that always struck me as kind of strange. And I just wonder if that's a little tiny indication that, anyhow, that Swedenborg could have been known to. That's just my way. Anyhow. Associating
just one God.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that probably was the real reason. This is Mr. Aga with some of his retinue. There he is smoking his nargile. Again, this one Swedish artist made a whole business out of these popular drawings. The second Ottoman envoy, Mehmed Said Efendi, accompanied by a retinue of 43, arrived in Stockholm in May of 1733 and stayed some time into 1734. Swedenborg was out of the country from April to July, so it's unclear whether he could have had access to the second envoy or not. There is Mr. Efendi. There he is again. There's Mr. Swedenborg. Am I suggesting that Swedenborg smoked the Nargala with Mr. Aga? Why not? Absolutely, yes, I am. If people can make unfounded charges against Swedenborg, I can say he smoked the Nargala. So, yeah, I think.
Can we quote you on that?
Yes.
Great quote.
Well, there's still, apparently in the Swedish and Ottoman archives, there's still a lot to be discovered. So maybe someday there will be some comment that will surface. Anyhow. So what could Swedenborg have known about Islam, both firsthand and secondhand? Probably a lot more than those who have questioned him. Okay, could Swedenborg have had access to the Quran? The person in the New Church Life article that basically said, poo-pooed the idea, the Quran was very hard to come by, et cetera, et cetera. The first Latin translation of the Quran, although deeply flawed, was produced in 1143, 5 centuries before Swedenborg's birth. In the early 13th century, more than 400 years before Swedenborg's birth, Mark of Toledo produced a more accurate Latin translation of the Quran. In the 15th century, Juan of Segovia produced another Latin translation of the Quran. In the 16th century, Juan Gabriel Terolensis and Cardinal Aguida de Viterbo produced yet another Latin translation of the Quran. In the early 17th century, still another translation of the Quran was made by Cyril Lucaris. And finally, in 1798, 10 years after Swedenborg was born, Ludovico Maracci, a teacher of the Arabic language at Sapienza University in Rome, issued a Latin translation with the Arabic text that included comments and notes from Islamic sources, the result of 40 years of exhaustive research and labor by the Benedictine monks. Various Catholic centers of learning throughout Europe had been studying Arabic since the 13th century. So, anyhow, could Swedenborg? There is Mr. Ludovico Maracci, a rather happy-looking individual. There is the copy of his Quran. And there is Surah Mecca. Anyhow, Swedenborg apparently did not possess a copy of the Quran in his own library. However, he presumably could have had access to one in the National Library of Sweden in Stockholm, which was in operation, or borrowed one from his well-educated and well-connected friends, or even discussed it with the Muslims that we all know were living in Stockholm. He presumably could have also had access to it during his travels throughout Europe, especially the year that he spent in Italy where Maracci's Quran was published. As a last resort, he might have been able to have access to it on the black market for illegal books that existed in Europe. To say that Swedenborg could not have had access to a copy of the Quran seems to be based on assumption and not on any historical facts. So, we are back to Jesus, the Son of God. I hope I'm pounding you with your information. I'm just going to keep pounding you until I'm done. I hope that's okay. I was going to ask for questions and comments about the God of the Quran, but I'm past that point, so I won't do it now. Okay, Jesus, the Son of God. The Mohammedans acknowledge the Lord as the greatest prophet and as the Son of God. This is what the writings say. The Mohammedan religion acknowledges the Lord as the Son of God. This is emphasized over and over and over in the writings. Here's what the Quran says. And the Christians say the Messiah is the Son of God. That is the saying in their mouths. They but imitate what the believers of old used to say. The curse of Allah be upon them. How they are turned away from the truth. The first thing we need to understand is that the heavenly doctrines completely reject the idea of a plurality of gods themselves. And they are certain, and they are also aware that the Mohammedans are completely hostile to the idea of a tripersonal God. Here's a quote from the writings. The Mohammedans are hostile to the Christians mainly because of the Christian belief in three divine persons and the consequent worship of three gods and as many creators. And still more hostile to the Roman Catholics because of their bending the knee before images. And for this reason, they call them idolaters. And the former they call fanatics, declaring that they make God a three-headed being. So the writings are completely aware of that the Mohammedans are opposed to a tripersonal God. So what are they talking about? Why would they say that? The only thing we really need to know to understand what the writings are talking about is Doctrine of the Lord 19. In the Doctrine of the Lord 19, there are three different definitions of the Son of God given. The Old Church definition, the Jewish Church definition, and the New Church definition. Here is the Old Church definition given in Doctrine of the Lord 19. In the Church, the Son of God is supposed to be the second person of the Godhead. The Quran completely rejects this. The writings completely reject this. I think it's fairly certain that the writings are not talking about this. The Jewish Church definition of the Son of God. In the Jewish Church, there was understood by the Son of God the Messiah, whom they had expected, and of whom they knew that he was to be born at Bethlehem. What does the Quran say? Does the Quran say that Jesus was the Messiah? O Mary, Allah has given thee glad tidings of a word from him. His name will be Al-Masih, the Messiah, Jesus. The Quran absolutely acknowledges Jesus as the Messiah. So in the Jewish Church definition of the Son of God, the writings are correct. The New Church definition of the Son of God, one of the New Church definitions of the Son of God. The Lord's human, conceived of Jehovah the Father and born of the Virgin Mary, is the Son of God. What does the Quran have to say? Does the Quran say that Jesus was conceived of Jehovah and born of the Virgin Mary? Here is one of four quotes. And Mary, the daughter of Imran, who guarded her chastity, and we breathed into her our spirit. Second, and remember she who guarded her chastity, and we breathed into her our spirit, and made her and her son a sign for all peoples. The third quote. And when the angel said, O Mary, indeed Allah has chosen you and purified you, chosen you above all the women of the world. Behold, the angel said, O Mary, surely Allah gives you good news of a word from him. His name will be Messiah, Jesus, the Son of Mary, held in honor in this world and the hereafter, and of those nearest to Allah. She said, My Lord, how will I have a child when no man has touched me? He said, So it will be. Allah creates what he wills. When he decrees a matter, he only says, Be, and it is. The fourth quote, and mentioned in the book, Mary, we sent to her our spirit, and he appeared before her as a perfect man. He said, I am only a messenger of your Lord, sent to announce to you the gift of a holy son. She said, How can I have a son when no man has touched me, and I have not been unchaste? He said, So it will be. The Lord says, and it is easy for me. It is a matter decreed. So there are four quotes in the writings that say that according to, in the Quran, thank you, that say that according to the New Church definition, the Quran teaches that Jesus is in fact the Son of God. So according to the Old Church definition, does the Quran teach that Jesus is the Son of God? Absolutely not. According to the Jewish Church definition, does the Quran teach that Jesus is the Son of God? Yes. According to the New Church definition, does the Quran teach that Jesus is the Son of God? Absolutely, 100% yes. I think you can all see where the truth is in this. Anyhow,